From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
If we do not see meaningful progress here today, the day will come when we will not confine our marching on Washington, but we will march through the South the way Sherman did, nonviolently, and they didn't like that. See, the night before the March on Washington, all of us, every one of us, including Dr. King, and I don't think he did it, but all of us were supposed to make advance copies of our speech available to the other people and to the media so they can have it. Julian Bond was the communication director for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he made copies of my speech available to all the other march leaders and to them. And so when Robert Kennedy and the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who was supposed to give an invocation, got a chance to see the speech, they said I had to change it. They was too inflammatory. And the Archbishop threatened not to give the invocation if I didn't change his speech. And so we had some discussion and argument.
The Honorable John Robert Lewis, U.S. House of Representatives from Georgia's 5th Congressional District. Lewis died on July 17, 2020. He was 80. Often called one of the most courageous persons the civil rights movement ever produced, Lewis dedicated his life to protecting human rights, securing civil liberties, and building what he called the beloved community in America. From 1963 to 1966, during the height of the civil rights movement, he was named chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which he helped form. While still a young man, Lewis became a nationally recognized leader. By 1963, he was dubbed one of the Big Six leaders of the Civil Rights Movement. In 1964, Lewis coordinated SNCC's effort to organize voter registration drives and community action programs during Mississippi Freedom Summer. Despite more than 40 arrests, physical attacks, and serious injuries, Lewis remained a devoted advocate of the philosophy of nonviolence. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the Honorable John Robert Lewis, Part 2, In Black America.
In 1963, there was a tremendous, unbelievable amount of activity in the civil rights movement. During the spring and summer 1963, hundreds of people had been arrested and jailed. In the spring of 63, April, May, in the city of Birmingham, Alabama, Bull Connor had used dogs and fire hoses. Megan Evers shot down, assassinated on June 12th, 1963. So something had to give. That same evening, President Kennedy spoke to the nation and said the question of civil rights, the question of race is a moral issue. He knew something had to happen because there were fires of frustration, as he said, was burning in every major city in America. So he called a group of us to the White House to meet with him.
In 1965, Lewis led one of the most dramatic nonviolent protests of the civil rights movement. Along with fellow activist Hosea Williams, Lewis led over 600 marches across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, on March 7th of that year. Alabama State Trooper attacked the marchers in a confrontation that became known as Bloody Sunday. Born on February 21, 1940, on a small farm outside of Troy, Alabama, Lewis attended segregated public schools in Pike County, Alabama. As a young man, he was inspired by the activism surrounding the Montgomery bus boycott and the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which he heard on radio broadcasts. Lewis holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Religion and Philosophy from Fisk University. In 1981, he was elected to the Atlanta City Council, and in 1986, he was elected to Congress. In spring of 2005, Lewis was the keynote speaker at the 19th Annual Heman M. Sweat Symposium on Civil Rights, held on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin. That year's theme was entitled Celebrating the 40th Anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. On today's program, we conclude our conversation.
It didn't matter whether you had a PhD degree, a law degree, whether you were a professor, doctor, or a very successful business person or not, but because you were black, you didn't look like them. And you could have been very successful. Because during those days, you had black men and black women teaching in colleges and universities, principals of high school, black lawyers, black doctors, couldn't even register to vote, simply because of the color of their skin. And in some parts of the South, we had to pass a so-called literacy test, pay a poll tax, interpret some section of the Constitution of Alabama or Mississippi. On one occasion, a black man was asked to get a number of bubbles on a bar of soap. And when you look back on it, it is really, it's unreal, it's unbelievable. In this state, rather than admit someone to a law school in Alabama, rather than admit someone to the University of Alabama, to the University of Georgia, we would build another school. We would pay that tuition to go out of state.
Congressman Lewis, tell us about leading up to that March on Washington in 1963.
In 1963, there was a tremendous, unbelievable amount of activity in the civil rights movement. During the spring and summer 1963, hundreds of people had been arrested and jailed. In the spring of 63, April, May, in the city of Birmingham, Alabama, Bull Connor had used dogs and fire hoses. Mega Everett shot down, assassinated on June 12th, 1963. So something had to give. That same evening, President Kennedy spoke to the nation and said the question of civil rights, the question of race, is a moral issue. He knew something had to happen, because there were fires of frustration, as he said, was burning in every major city in America. So he called a group of us to the White House to meet with him. A few days early, I had just been elected the national chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And among the people who met with President Kennedy, Vice President Lyndon Johnson, Attorney General Robert Kennedy and others, was A. Philip Randolph, who was the Dean of Black Labor, Black Leadership. He was a black labor leader, wonderful man. Martin Luther King Jr., James Farmer, head of CORE, Roy Wilkin of the NAACP, and Whitney Young of the Urban League. Mr. Randolph, he was our spokesperson. Was not Dr. King, or James Farmer, or Roy Wilkin, or Whitney Young, or anyone else, but A. Phil Randolph, because he was the dean. He was the oldest person in the group. And he spoke up, and he said in his baritone voice, he said, "Mr. President, the black monsters are restless, and we're going to march on Washington." And you can tell by the very body language of President Kennedy. He didn't like what he heard. He started sort of twisting in his chair. And then he finally said something. He said, "Mr. Randolph, if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be violence and chaos, and we would never get a civil rights bill through the Congress?" And Mr. Randolph responded and said, "Mr. President, this would be an orderly, nonviolent, and peaceful protest. We're going to march on Washington." So President Kennedy sort of said, we have problems, but they're man-made problems. They'll be solved by man. He had to lead a meeting, and he left President, Vice President Lyndon Johnson in charge. And we had a few more words with the Vice President, Attorney General. We left the meeting as a group. We came out on the lawn of the White House, announced to the media that we've had a very productive meeting with the President and the Vice President and the Attorney General. And in a few days, we will be organizing and making a major announcement for March on Washington. And that was the beginning of that idea of the March on Washington. So on July 2nd, 1963, the six of us met in New York City at a hotel there and issued a call and invited four major white religious and labor leaders to join us. And between that time, of July 2nd, 63, and August 28, 1963, we were able to mobilize the country in such a fashion that more than 250,000 Americans showed up at the March on Washington. I think it was many, many more than 250,000. I think that was one of the greatest undercount of all kind. But when you see those photographs and how people was there between Mr. Lincoln and Mr. Washington, I don't think there had been anything like that since, really. The closest thing to it was the Million Man March. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that day. How did you feel the reaction? How did you start your day in August?
Well, that August day, the six of us met at a local hotel. Most of us had breakfast together, and we were very hopeful, very optimistic. We was feeling pretty good that we can just get maybe 50 or 70,000 people to show. We left in cars, and we went up to Capitol Hill. I had never been to Capitol Hill before. We went up, and we met with the Democrat and the Republican House leadership. Had a wonderful meeting, and also with the, not just with the Speaker and the Minority Leader, but we also met with the Chair of the House Judiciary Committee and the ranking member on the Republican side. Then we went on the Senate side, and we met with the Senate Majority Leader and the Republican Minority Leader and the head of the Judiciary Committee, because that's where the civil rights bill would come out of the committees. And then we decided that cars would pick us up and drive us to the as close as possible to the Lincoln Memorial. And when we came out of the Senate office building, we saw a sea of humanity, just hundreds and thousands of people coming from toward Union Station. And we were supposed to be leading the march. And the people were already marching. So when we walked out to get in the car, we said, we can't ride. That's the cars can't make it through this crowd. We have to walk. So we all hooked on, caught each other's hand, and we started walking. And it was a sea of humanity just literally pushing us on down Constitution Avenue, pushing us by the Washington Monument on to the Lincoln Memorial. It was a wonderful day. It was a beautiful day. I had been working on a speech for some time. And before finishing the speech, and I had a lot of help from my colleagues in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I was reading a copy of the New York Times, and I saw a group of black women in Southern Africa. And they were carrying signs, and the sign said, one man, one vote. So in my March on Washington speech, I said something like, one man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too. It must be ours. And that sort of became sort of the rallying cry. But then in the beginning of the speech, I said something like, this is the prepared text. In good conscience, we cannot support the administration proposed civil rights bill, for it is too little and it is too late. But there's not anything in this bill that will protect old women and young children involved in peaceful demonstration from being run down by policemen on horses and chased by police dogs, something to that effect. And then when I got on down in the speech, I said something like, listen, Mr. President, listen, Mr. Kennedy, listen, members of Congress, you want to take the revolution out of the streets and put it in the courts. So, and then I went on, it was play on words. And so we want our freedom and we want it now. You tell us to wait. You tell us to be patient. We cannot wait. We cannot be patient. We want our freedom and we want it now. And near the very end of the speech, I had a line in there that says something like, if we do not see meaningful progress here today, the day will come when we will not confine our marching on Washington, but we will march through the South the way Sherman did, nonviolently, and they didn't like that. So, see, the night before the march on Washington, all of us, every one of us, including Dr. King, and I don't think he did it, but all of us were supposed to make advanced copies of our speech available to the other people and to the media so they can have it. Julian Bond was the communication director for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he made copies of my speech available to all the other march leaders and to them. And so when Robert Kennedy and the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who was supposed to give an invocation, got a chance to see the speech, they said I had to change it. They was too inflammatory. And the Archbishop threatened not to give the invocation if I didn't change the speech. And so we had some discussion and argument. And the march was, people were there, the program had started. And we were sitting behind Mr. Lincoln, right on the side of Mr. Lincoln. That would have been on his right side, sitting over in a corner with a portable typewriter, trying to change his speech, his words. And at one point, Mr. Randolph said to me, John, I don't have any problem with revolution, with black muscles. I use it myself sometimes. I knew you did. So that stayed in because some people want that out. And I said, we marched through the South the way Sherman did. Dr. King said, John, that didn't sound like you. And Mr. Randolph said, John, for the sake of unity, can we change that? We come this far together. let's stay together. So you can say no to A. Philip Randolph. So I changed that and suggested that we would march through certain cities in the South as well as in the North. But after the program got underway and the music and people were speaking and I was introduced, I got up, I looked to my right, I looked to my left, I looked straight ahead, then I looked back to the right again, and I saw all of these young people from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee cheering and sort of saying, go on, go on, and I just went for it.
What led up to the march in 65 when you all crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge between Selma and Montgomery?
In Selma, Alabama, like so much of the South, very few black people were registered to vote. There were one county between Selma and Montgomery. The county was more than 80% African American. It didn't have a single registered African American voter in the county. In Selma, Alabama itself, only 2.1% of blacks of voting age were registered to vote. A state like the state of Mississippi next door to Alabama, Selma is not that far from the Mississippi state line. Mississippi had a black voting age population more than 450,000, and only about 16,000 blacks were registered to vote.
We'll be back with more in Black America after this message. And now back to this episode of In Black America.
We have been in and out of Selma since 1962. People have been arrested, jailed, beaten. They couldn't pass the so-called literacy test. They were standing in these unmovable lines. So even while we were being involved in Mississippi during the summer of 64, we had an ongoing effort in Mississippi, in Selma, rather. Mm-hmm. In Selma, you had a sheriff. He was a mean man. He was a big man, and he was mean. And not only were black people afraid of him, but a lot of white people were afraid of this guy. He was really something of another time. He wore a gun on one side, a nightstick on the other side, and he carried an electric cap router in his hand, and he didn't use it on cows. He wore a button on his left lapel that said never, never to voter registration. He guarded the courthouse like it was his own house. The only time that you could attempt to register to vote in Selma, well, on the first and third Mondays of each month. And the only place you could go was to the courthouse. You had to go down to the courthouse, go up some steps, go through a set of double doors. You turn to your left, get a copy of the so-called literacy test, and try to pass that test. And if you pass the test, DNA will let you know, maybe in a few days, if you can register to vote. And people did that day in and day out, stood in a movable line. On one occasion, when it was my day to lead a group of people to the courthouse, it was January the 18th, 1965. Sheriff Clark met us at the top of the step. There were about 60 elderly black men and women walking behind me. We got at the top of the step, and he said, John Lewis, you're an outside agitator. You're the lowest form of humanity. I looked him straight in the eye, and I said, Sheriff, I may be an agitator, but I'm not an outsider. I grew up only 90 miles from here, and we're going to stay here until these people are allowed to register to vote. He said, you're under arrest. And he arrested me along with other people. We all went to jail, all of us, every single one of us. I've been arrested before and going to jail before in Nashville, Mississippi, Georgia, and other places, so it was okay. A few days later, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Ralph Abernathy, a colleague of Dr. King, came to Selma, held a mass meeting, and the next day or so, they marched to the courthouse with a group of people. They all were arrested, including Dr. King. More than 300 people, teachers, students, lawyers, doctors, ministers, they filled the city jail, the county jail, the city stockade. And then about a week later, in a little town called Marion, Alabama, this is in Perry County, this is in the heart of the Black Belt. Marion, Alabama, and Perry County, is the home county of Mrs. Martin Luther King Jr., Mrs. Ralph Abernathy, and the late Mrs. Andrew Young, Jean Young. They all come from the same place. This young black man, a veteran, Jimmie Lee Jackson, was involved in a march for the right to vote at night. Nighttime demonstrations are pretty dangerous. Mm-hmm. A confrontation occurred. He tried to protect his elderly mother. He was shot in the stomach by a state trooper. And a few days later, he died at a local hospital in Selma. And because of what happened to him, we made a decision to march from Selma to Montgomery. The original idea was maybe, just maybe, we shouldn't bury Jimmie Lee Jackson's body in Marion, Alabama, but literally take his body to Montgomery and place it on the Capitol steps. And then we said, well, maybe we shouldn't do that. Let's march. So we decided to march on Sunday, March 7, 1965. We all went to church at a local church. After church, we conducted a nonviolent workshop. More than 600 of us, men and women, a lot of young people, young children, lined up in twos to walk from Selma to Montgomery. It was a March day. It was breeze blowing. I was wearing a light trench coat. Jose Williams from Dr. King Organization was walking beside me. The two of us were leading the march. He was wearing a black trench coat. We get to the highest point on the bridge. Down below, we see a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers. And then behind the state troopers, you saw the sheriff deputies. Mm-hmm. And then on horseback, you saw members of Sheriff Clark Posse. Sheriff Clark had requested the night before that all white men over the age of 21 to come down to the courthouse and be deputized to become part of his posse to stop the march. So we will continue to walk. We come within hearing distance of the state troopers. A man identified himself and said, I'm Major John Cloud of the Alabama State Troopers. This is an unlawful march. You will not be allowed to continue. I give you 3 minutes to disperse and return to your church. And Jose Williams said to the major, Major, give us a moment to pray. And before we can pass the word back for the other marchers to kneel and pray, Major John Cloud said, troopers advance. And you saw these men putting on their gas masks. Mm-hmm. And they came toward us, beating us with nightsticks and bullwhips, tramping us with horses and releasing the tear gas. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. I had a concussion at the bridge. I felt my legs given away. And I thought I was going to die. I thought I saw death. And I lost consciousness. And to this day, 40 years later, I don't know how I made it back across that bridge, back through the streets of Selma, for about six blocks, back to that little church. But I do recall being back at the church that Sunday afternoon, and the church was full, more than 2,000 people on the outside trying to get in to protest what had happened. And someone asked me to say something, and I stood up and I said, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. How President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam, but can I send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people who only desire to register to vote? And the next thing I knew, I had been admitted to the local hospital in Selma. And that next morning, Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy came by to visit me. And Dr. King said something like, don't worry, John, we'll make it from Selma to Montgomery. The Voting Rights Act will be passed. And he said that he had issued a call for religious leaders to come to Selma that following day, March 9th, that Tuesday. More than 1,000 ministers, priests, rabbis, and nuns came, and they marched to the point where we had been beaten 2 days early. Mm-hmm. They kneeled, prayed, had a hymn. They went back. And that evening of March 9th, three young white ministers went out to try to get something to eat at a restaurant. And there was one young minister from Boston, the Reverend James Reed. They were attacked by members of the Klan. He was hit in the head with a lead pipe. And a day or two later, he died at a local hospital in Birmingham. But the nation couldn't understand it when they saw the photographs in the newspapers and magazine. They saw the video on television. They couldn't believe it. So there was demonstration all over America at the Department of Justice, at the White House, at the American embassies abroad, and almost every college campus. People got in the street. And from this state, unbelievable United States Senator probably spoke the most meaningful words on the Senate floor with Senator Yarbrough. Mm-hmm. He said, shame on you, George Wallace. This is the United States of America. This is not Russia. How can you let people beat your fellow citizens like they did? Shame on you, George Wallace. President Johnson was so disturbed about what happened. He invited Governor Wallace to come to Washington to meet with him at the White House. He tried to get assurance from George Wallace that Wallace would be able to protect him if we decided to march again. Wallace could not assure the president. Mm. So President Lyndon Johnson made a decision He spoke to a joint session of the Congress, spoke to the nation on March 15, 1965, and perhaps made one of the most meaningful speeches than any American president had made in modern time on the whole question of civil rights and voting rights. He started that speech off that night by saying, "I speak tonight for the dignity of man and for the destiny of democracy." President Johnson went on to say, "At time, history and fate meet in a single place in man on in his search for freedom." So it was more than a century ago in Lexington and Concord. So it was at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. He said, "The wind of protest is sweeping the country. We must act, and I plan to act tonight." He said, "One man was killed, a good man of God." He was talking about Reverend Reed. And he said, "Tonight I'm going to present to the Congress a voting rights act about outlawing literacy tests, the poll tax, making this simple and convenient for people to register to vote." And before he ended that speech, he said over and over again, "And we shall overcome." I was sitting next to Martin Luther King Jr. in the home of a local family when Lyndon Johnson kept saying, "And we shall overcome." I looked at Dr. King and he started crying. Tears came down his face and we all cried when we heard Lyndon Johnson say, "And we shall overcome." That was a turning point. And we knew then it was just a matter of time the Congress would pass the Voting Rights Act and President Johnson would sign it into law.
Final question, Congressman Lewis. What should we learn as Americans from this period of our history?
More than anything else, I think we should learn that a group of citizens, just ordinary men and women, made up their mind that they were going to be free, that they were going to end segregation and racial discrimination in polling places, at the ballot box, registrar's office, that they were going to end segregation in places of public accommodation, public transportation, in schools and colleges and university. They made up their mind. And they made up their mind that they were going to get in the way. My folks told me not to get in the way. And we got in the way. They made up their mind that they were going to stand up and fight and speak up and speak out. And this generation today, sometimes I think the generation today is too quiet. Need to make a little noise. We made a little noise. And they need to find a way to get in the way.
This has been a tribute to the Honorable John Robert Lewis, U.S. House of Representatives from Georgia's 5th Congressional District. Lewis died on July 17, 2020. He was 80. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.